Amen. All right, I want to welcome everybody to the Master's Class here at Summit Church. So we're going to be talking about God's business advice, and we're in chapter 6 of the book of Proverbs. And, you know, it's interesting to me that God gives us a whole lot more advice than just religious advice. He gives us a lot of sound advice for just living lives, right? And chapter 6 of the book of Proverbs covers several different subjects. Now, the section we're going to be covering today starts with some advice that is good for anyone in the business world today, for Christians and non-Christians. And these are simply some good business principles. And it's interesting to me that God has given us a lot of good advice for all of mankind, the saved as well as the unsaved. So, we got several business people here in the class. If I were to ask you what are the keys to running a successful business, what would you say are the main ones? What are the main keys to running a successful business? Anybody? Honesty. Honesty? All right. Hiring the right people. Absolutely. Good employees. Man, those employees, A, they work for you. They represent you. They're out there doing the things that you want them to do. What else? I'm sorry, what? A good sponsor. Yeah, okay. A good sponsor in the business place. For the employee, is that what you're thinking about, Marcia? Okay, advertising. All right. Yeah, good advertising. What else? Pay them well. Pay your employees what they're worth, right? Don't try to cut them. That changes the attitudes of employees a lot when you're paying them what they're worth, right? Some of them won't work for that. Yeah, some of them won't work for that. That's right. Yeah. Sometimes they're not worth very much, right? Yeah. You need to compliment them every once in a while. Yeah, you need to tell them they're doing a good job. Yeah, absolutely. What else? Delegate. You can't do it all yourself, huh? Yeah, you know, and whatever business it is, you got to make sure you have a product that people want, right? I mean, if you've got a product and nobody wants it, you're not going to have a very successful business. And then you got to make sure that it sells for an amount that people are willing to give up their hard-earned money for, right? So it's got to be priced right. And you got to have good customer service, you know, both before and after the sale. Now, when it comes to choosing who you're going to buy from, you know, customer service can usually win the ties. Now, price is generally first, but if it's a tie or close to it, good customer service can win out in those situations. If you know you've got somebody that's going to support you after the sale, that's a whole lot better, and that's worth something, right, to be able to do that. And then having good employees, as we said, and then being innovative with your product. We tell the stories at our work about Swiss watchmakers and how, you know, at one time they dominated the entire watch industry, so forth, and then along came digital watches. And you almost never find a Swiss watch anymore. If you do, they're one of the higher priced, really top of the line type things that people want. But it was because the Swiss watchmakers refused to be innovative with their product and changed, because they had a chance first to look at the digital watches, and they turned it down and said nobody will buy one of those digital watches. Yeah. And so they lost their business because they weren't being innovative with their product. You got to always be improving the products that you're trying to sell. And then, obviously, being able to manage your finances well, like when to borrow money and just plain hard work. Those are two key factors. Knowing how to manage money, knowing when to go get a loan, when not to get a loan, how to balance the books and only spend what you're supposed to spend. But really and truly, it boils down to just plain hard work to make a business successful, right? Now, these are all things that you can learn from any business training class. You see, I just gave you guys a seminar on, on business training that you probably have to pay thousands of dollars to go learn these principles, and I gave it to you for free right here today. You see, you got some real value. There you go, yeah. You got some real value out of this here this morning. So, God also has some pretty good advice for the business person in our lesson today on the topics of loans, hard work, and the kind of people that you need to be careful around, right? So there are some types of people out there in the business world you need to be on the watch out for, right? You need to be careful of. And a lot of these principles apply to our personal lives as well as our business. I just kind of picked on business today just to have something to talk about. But as has been the case on several of our lessons, God provides His advice by using the illustration of Solomon giving his advice to his children. But just as before, I want you to think of this as God giving His advice to His children, be they men, women, boys, or girls. This is God sharing His wisdom on how to have and live a victorious Christian life. Now, something we all need to pay attention to, and along the way, He is telling us how to be successful in our business lives and in our personal lives as well. So, got some good lessons for us here today. And the first one that we're going to start off with is the problem of guaranteeing somebody else's loan. The problem of guaranteeing somebody else's loan. Let's start today in our focus verses, chapter 6, verse 1. And he says, "My son, if thou be surety for a friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger." So now the problem that God is presenting here to us in this verse is fairly simple, but it can really become very serious. You know, and that is becoming surety for a friend, or in other words, guaranteeing a loan so that someone who does not have enough credit can get the loan, or what is being called a co-signer on a loan. Everybody familiar with the concept of being a co-signer on a loan? Yeah. Well, God says to be careful about doing that, whether that person is a friend or a stranger. Now, this is an event that occurs pretty often when a child asks their parents for help in getting a loan, say for their first house. It can also happen when your brother-in-law, that one whose ideas never work and who is constantly in debt, wants you to co-sign on a loan for his next project, right? Now, so it can also be friends who are asking this. It can even be strangers who ask. In any of these cases, God is telling you to beware of becoming surety for somebody else's loan. Now, the context of this story in our verses would say that the person who had been asked to co-sign on the loan had already agreed to do so with his friend, but it hadn't gotten to the banker yet. So they hadn't made it to the bank, but he had told his friend he was going to do it. And then the person who was going to co-sign started having second thoughts about it because of the risk that it would bring to him if his friend failed to pay the loan back. In other words, this person had been persuaded to agree to this and following his heart rather than his head. He let his heart lead him rather than his common sense, right? And he soon began to realize the risk that he faced in his own life if this went south. Now, I'm sure you guys have all figured this out by now, but the way banks assess finances of someone applying for a loan and decide if that person is a good risk or not is interesting as well as it is frustrating to the person trying to get the loan. Because as a rule, a bank will loan money only to a person who has money, right? Now, which, of course, is frustrating to the person asking for the loan because the reason they're asking for the loan is they don't have the money, right? Or they would just spend their own money. Why would they go to the bank if they already got the money, right? Now, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Now, the idea of borrowing money in the first place is a whole other topic that we're going to cover in another lesson, right? But suffice to say, today we got a loan, and the guy has promised to co-sign it. But any time you borrow to buy something today, hoping to pay it back with money you haven't earned yet, That is an element fraught with risk, for there is no guarantee of what your future income will be, and the banks know that that's true. The banks know that that's true. That's why they want somebody to have money already before they give you money, right? Because there's no guarantee you're going to have your job tomorrow. So when a bank decides to decline a loan to a customer, the bank will often ask, do you know anyone who would co-sign your note for you? Because you see, the bank, they want the best of both worlds. They want to make the customer happy by giving them the loan, and they want some kind of security that would lower the risk of the loan. And the solution is for the customer to find a co-signer. Then if the customer defaults, it's only the co-signer who's unhappy. It's not the customer and it's not the bank, because they both got what they wanted. It is the person who chose to co-sign the loan that is unhappy at having to pay a loan back and getting nothing for it, right? When you co-sign a loan, you don't get the money. You don't get the benefit. All you get is the responsibility for paying back a loan that somebody else didn't pay back, right? So he's the one that's unhappy. So in this case, it appears that the person who agreed to co-sign the loan was a good friend to the person needing the loan. And this means that person, out of the goodness of his heart, was willing to give his friend a break. And sometimes this arrangement works, and sometimes it doesn't, right? And many times it doesn't, that when you're doing it with a friend, right? And so Solomon points out the problem that exists to his son in verse 2. Thou art snared with the words of thy mouth, thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. And this means that up to this point, the agreement was in words only, and the co-signer has made his promise only to his friend, but not to the bank. And this means that the possibility still exists that the co-signer can get himself out of this situation. But first, he needs to evaluate the difficult situation into which his promise has put him. Now, he may be mortgaging his own future to help out his friend. Now, and he can no more afford to guarantee his friend's debt than his friend can afford to incur the debt himself. So God's advice in this situation is to get out of it. Verse 3 says, do this now, my son, deliver thyself. When thou art come into the hand of thy friend, go, humble thyself, and make sure thy friend. So Solomon says, go, humble thyself, and make sure thy friend. So the co-signer-to-be must put his pride in his pocket and go back to his friend, confess that he's made a mistake, and seek to be released from his promise. Now, hopefully, the request will not ruin the friendship. But that's what God is saying. Try to save the friendship, but get out of this, right? And if he is a true friend, he's going to release the co-signer from his generous but rash promise, and then he'll go out and seek another solution to the financial problem that he has. But with friends and family, that can be a problem in and of itself. If you were to go back and try to cancel your promise that you were going to co-sign, right? I mean, once you've said something, it can get pretty tough, right? Even if you just say no up front, it can be pretty tough in a family or friend situation. And so then Solomon emphasizes the urgency of the situation when he says, do this now, my son, and deliver thyself, when thou art come into the hand of thy friend. And then in verse 5 it says, give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. So what he's saying is, the longer the delay, the more difficult it will be to undo the damage. Because once that person asking for the loan tells the bank about the promise of the co-signer, it's going to be too late. The co-signer will be honor bound to follow up on his promise. Now, so haste is needed so that the transaction will not proceed that far. It won't get to the bank. So once the pledge gets into the hands of that creditor, that die is cast. And history, if anything, reveals that money lenders invariably get their pound of flesh back. Now, they will collect the money from you, right? So, in one way or another. And so then Solomon gives an example of the type of urgency that is needed. Verse 5 says, deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. Now, the word roe here is described as a deer. And Solomon is saying that both the deer and the bird rely on speed to escape danger, right? That's the way they get away. And it's that type of speed that the cosigner needs to take in getting to his friend. He's got to rush and get over there. This counsel contains a great deal of common sense. Because what good is a promise, however well-intentioned, when the cosigner simply does not have the means to keep it? So the promise only gives a false sense of security to the one getting the loan and even to the one being the cosigner. You're like, you know, I'm being helpful. I'm being a good friend here, but you really can't afford to be that good friend. And so it gives a false sense of security to both of you. It's far better to face reality for both people before they lose everything. It's far better to save a friendship by honesty and common sense than to see a friendship end in bitterness and hard feelings and recrimination. And it's far better to face an awkward fact at the outset while it's still possible to make a more realistic arrangement. So everything is depending on honesty and speed. So God's advice to would-be cosigners of a loan is to look before you leap. And if you made a mistake, hurry up and get it changed before the loan takes place. Now, that's pretty good advice for just about anybody, wouldn't you say? That's pretty good advice. Now, next, God talks about the wisdom of working hard at whatever you do, but especially in the context of making a business succeed. And we talk about the ant's wisdom. So now, wisdom in financial matters has many sides to it. Now, we can become poor by something we do, like being surety for a friend, or we can be poor and we can become poor by something we don't do, like being lazy and refusing to work. Now, one's just as bad as the other. Now, most of us seasoned citizens, that's a good description for us, right? Seasoned citizens. Learned our work ethic early on in life, right? I've told you guys before, my dad used to say I was building character whenever I was doing his chores around the house. He could come up with all kinds of things for me to do, and he was saying he was building my character. Well, he built quite a character out of me, let me tell you. But we learned how to work hard early in our lives. And we've been blessed by God to have work to do, and we have worked hard all of our lives to earn all of the things that we have. And God has blessed us with those things by the work that He has allowed us to do. Now, a person who has worked for their entire life usually has little use for those who try to get by being lazy. Right? I haven't got a whole lot of patience for people being lazy and for people hoping that others will take care of them, like letting the government take from those who pay taxes and give it to those that don't pay taxes, right? You know, perhaps nothing irritates an organized, energetic, dynamic individual more than the sight of a lazy person lying in bed, lolling around the house, wasting time, and letting opportunities slip by and then complain because they don't have anything that they want, right? So if you want to lay down and be lazy, that's fine with me. Just don't expect me to take care of you, right? Yeah. And so God's wisdom has much to say to us if we have become that lazy person. And here He contrasts that lazy person with the busy ant. Verse 6 says, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise." I notice that God really doesn't mince a whole lot of words when it comes to describing that lazy person. He calls him thou sluggard, right? Now, the word sluggard is translated from a Hebrew word that means slothful or work shy, lazy, or lethargic. That's a pretty good description, right? Yeah. Now, God tells this sluggard to go to the ant, consider her ways, and be wise. I don't know about y'all, but I've watched ant colonies before. You guys ever sat down and just watched an ant colony? When I was a kid, we had those plastic ant, traps or whatever, a cage or colony, you know, where you could keep pet ants and watch them dig tunnels and all kinds of stuff through stuff. And I've watched ants before. But when you watch an ant colony, the first thing you notice is that the ants never seem to be still. They're always moving. The ant colony is built on the twin principles of discipline and work. There is constant motion. And if the colony is disturbed, then its activity accelerates to a fever pitch. Man, you just see them all running around. Have you ever stuck a stick into an anthill just to see things going on? And man, those ants just go everywhere, go crazy, right? Trying to come at it. It shows you my character, right? That I'll sit there and pester ants just to watch them go, right? But the ants world has always fascinated people. It seems so much like our own world, yet it is an absolutely, utterly alien world. God wants the lazy person to notice that the ants work without force. He's not compelled to work by some boss or ruler. He works because it is in his nature to work. Verse 7 says, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler. He works having no guide, overseer, or ruler. Now, the ant colony is centered around the queen. Now, the queen is bigger than her subjects, but she is really simply an egg-laying machine. That's all she really does. Her function is to provide millions of eggs to that the workers will take and cultivate as needed. And the workers tell the queen what kind of ants are needed for the continued well-being of the colony. Therefore, keeping a colony in balance is a joint effort between the workers and the queen. The workers continually attend to the queen, and she responds to the stimuli that she receives. Now, this joint enterprise ensures that there will always be the proper proportion of workers and soldiers and eggs and future queens to ensure the colony's survival. Now, people admire the efficiency of the ant colony. It is highly structured, ruthlessly efficient, and tightly controlled. Now, in fact, in some ways, communism is an effort by misguided men to produce a human society modeled on the ant colony. But the problem is that people aren't ants. And so ant society is organized by blind instinct. But people aren't puppets. They cannot be bred, regimented, sorted by class, and manipulated like ants, at least not without an eventual collapse of that society taking place. Now, understand that God is not telling us to live in a colony like the ant. What He is telling us is to look at the ant's work ethic and the fact that ants do not have to be forced to work. Ants are not lazy, or they're not sluggards, as Scripture calls the lazy person. They are an example of a person who has industry as part of their nature. They do not need a slave driver to make sure they get up in the morning and fulfill their appointed task. That's the kind of employee you want, right? You want somebody who will come to work and do the tasks that need to be done, not because you're forcing them to do it, but because they enjoy their work, they enjoy getting the things done that need to be done, and they take an interest in making sure it happens, right? So God is telling the sluggard to consider that concept, the concept of working because it is in your nature to work, not because your boss forces you to do it. Now, God also points out that the ant works without fail. You know, come wind or weather, that ant goes about his business undeterred by the circumstances that it encounters. Verse 8 says, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. So all ants are instinctively looking ahead. And while the season is favorable, they prepare for the hard days to come. Now, what the ants do by blind instinct, people ought to do as a matter of simple common sense. Prepare for that day that you're going to need, that, you know, prepare for a rainy day, you know, save for a rainy day. You know, with this pandemic that came along and all of a sudden all the toilet paper was gone, taught everybody to prepare for a rainy day when there wasn't any toilet paper, right? You know, lots of things that you have to do to prepare for that rainy day because tragedy will come in your life, right? So these are just things we ought to do as a matter of simple common sense. Solomon had often watched the ants at work, and he admired their efficiency. He had seen those busy ant scouts ranging far and wide to look for sources of food. He had seen the ant soldiers quickly take on intruders, and he had seen the panic when an ant hill was disturbed, and the little creatures run around like crazy to repair the damage. And the first concern is to get the eggs out of the way of danger, and activity then swiftly settles down to an organized efficiency, and then almost miraculously, the damage is repaired, and the ants resume the ordinary business of life. So they're out seeking and storing up food. That's what they're doing. So next, God rebukes the lazy person, and he's asking in verse 9, "How long wilt thou sleep, old sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep?" Now, I know I'm going to get in trouble for this, especially, not with you guys, but with the podcast, because people listening in. But this verse brings to mind the pajama boy of today's world that's 35 years old, still living in his mother's basement, and his mother's yelling down, "How long wilt thou sleep, old sluggard? When wilt thou rise out of thy sleep?" Or words to that effect, right? Now, I'm sure she doesn't use King James English when she does it. But, you know, that kind of attitude and that kind of a person who's the one I've got in mind here in this description. Now, in the book Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan, everybody familiar with Pilgrim's Progress and John Bunyan, yeah, used a conversation between Christian and Hopeful, which were two characters in the story, to warn against laziness. And Bunyan writes, "I saw then in my dream that they went till they came into a certain country, whose air naturally tended to make one drowsy if he came a stranger into it. And here Hopeful began to be very dull and heavy of sleep. Wherefore he said unto Christian, I do now begin to grow so drowsy that I can scarcely hold up my eyes. Let us lie down here and take a nap. And Christian says, by no means, lest sleeping we never awake more. And Hopeful says, well, why, my brother? Sleep is sweet to the laboring man. We may be refreshed if we take a nap. And Christian says, do you not remember that one of the shepherds bid us beware of the enchanted ground? He meant by that that we should beware of sleeping, meaning that if they fall asleep on this enchanted ground, they ain't getting back up. So better stay awake, right? Well, God has that same advice for us in 1 Thessalonians 5:6. It says, therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. So next, knowing all of the lazy man's excuses, God tells us how that lazy man thinks. In verse 10, yet a little slumber, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. Don't you, you ever told yourself that? You know, when you don't really want to get up and go do what you want to do. But that lazy man, that's the way he's thinking. Yeah, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. Well, that's how the lazy man reasons when he thinks about starting any serious work project. He yawns, he stretches, he finds a shady spot where he is protected from the full strength of that summer sun, and he settles down, and he tells himself, I'll get started on that project, but first I'm just going to take a little nap. I need a little rest to get up the energy for it. Then he yawns, and he falls asleep, and he wastes the entire afternoon sleeping, right? Just a little nap. That's the lazy man's excuse for idling away his time. Now, of course, there is such a thing as a healthy nap. Now, I'm not telling you that you shouldn't take naps. As I've gotten older, the help of a good nap is a cherished thing, right? Now, usually on Sunday afternoon, even on Saturday afternoons, right, I look forward to a good nap. You know, Sunday is a day of rest, and I take seriously the Lord's commandment that I am to rest, right? I mean, by the time I get done teaching here in the mornings, I'm tired, I'm ready to go home and take a nap, right? But unfortunately, I can't take a nap every day because my bosses at work take a really dim view of me stretching out and napping during the time they think I ought to be working that they're paying me wages for, right? So there is a time and a place for everything. God is telling us that when the time is ripe for getting work done, That's not the time to be sleeping your day away. Now, that's pretty straightforward, right? Yeah, that's pretty straight, good advice. And so God asked, how long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? And then God describes the consequences of being lazy. Verse 11. So shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. Now the Hebrew word translated as poverty refers to being in want of the necessities of life. So the lazy man can expect to be left without the necessities of life. So his misfortunes are already coming toward him as he rolls over in his bed of idleness. His poverty is coming as one that traveleth, or as a highwayman. It's coming like an armed man. They're going to take everything away from you that you have for the necessities of life. That's what's going to happen if you stay in bed and are lazy or as a sluggard. So the word picture here is certainly vivid. The lazy man will be helpless when poverty comes, as helpless as a man looking into the barrel of a robber's gun. That's kind of the idea that that God is trying to give us. So that's the lazy man. That's the lazy man. Don't be a sluggard. Don't be a lazy man. And so then God tells us about the wicked man. And you see, all these are just common sense things, right? I mean, there's nothing religious, there's nothing super theoretical or theological about all this. This is just stuff on how to conduct your life, right? So now God tells us about the wicked man. Verses 12 and 13. A naughty person, a wicked man, walketh with a froward mouth. He winketh with his eyes, he speaketh with his feet, and he teacheth with his fingers. So the expression translated as a naughty person literally means a worthless person. And the word translated wicked means injurious. And the word's derived from a word that has the meaning the breaking up of all that is good. So God is describing here moral depravity, corruption, and lewdness when he talks about the wicked man. So God is painting a picture of the kind of man who uses nods and winks and gestures to communicate his wishes or his intentions to his partners, or in some way to try to get the person he's trying to take advantage of to be conned, if you will, and take advantage of him. God is telling us not to be deceived by such people. We are to read the person's body language as well as any other language, for these types of people are worthless and wicked. So next, God describes the wicked man's deceit, and he says in verse 14, frowardness is in his heart. He deviseth mischief continually, and he soweth discord. So now, the word translated frowardness can also be translated as deceitfulness. Deceitfulness, mischief, and discord are the things that make that wicked man happy in his work. He's not worried at all that what he says and does is going to harm the lives of other people. Now, of all the reprehensible frauds who prey upon the world, religious frauds are the absolutely worst. God gives us an example of this type of fraud in the book of 1 Kings chapter 13, and I want to talk about this story. He tells us of an old prophet that lived in Bethel, and when Jeroboam set up his false altar at Bethel, the old prophet's sons went to the dedication while the old prophet stayed at home. Now his sons, they come home filled with excitement. 1 Kings 13, verse 11 says, now there dwelt an old prophet in Bethel, and his sons came and told him all the works that the man of God had done that day in Bethel, and the words which he had spoken unto the king. Them they told also to their father. So they told the story of a young prophet from neighboring Judah who had appeared out of nowhere, and he had denounced the king and the false priest and the altar. It was a golden calf altar that they had built and put on this, and so he had denounced them for this. And he had then smitten the king by miraculously paralyzing his arm, and then just as miraculously, he had healed him when the king pleaded for mercy. So then the king had invited the young prophet to the palace for the meal. And the young prophet had categorically refused saying that his mandate from heaven forbade him to break bread with anyone at Bethel, which was now cursed with Jeroboam's golden calf, this new idol that they had put up at this altar. So the news created the feelings of envy and jealousy in the old prophet, because here was this young upstart, and he was coming into his territory, and he was telling the king things, and he was doing things that the old prophet wished he had been able to do, right? And so the prophet, old prophet, couldn't have this young guy in his territory, and so he resorts to a policy of deception and mischief. So he goes out and he finds the young prophet and he invites him to come home for the night. And we start off in verses 14. And went out after the man of God and found him sitting under an oak, and said unto him, Art thou the man of God that camest from Judah? And he said, I am. And then he said unto him, Come home with me and eat bread. And he said, I may not return with thee, nor go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water with thee in this place. For it was said to me by the word of the Lord, Thou shalt eat no bread nor drink water there, nor turn again to go by the way that thou camest. So then God tells us of the deceit of the old prophet that he used as he replies to this young prophet. And he starts in verse 18. And he said unto him, I am a prophet also as thou art. It's all right, buddy. I'm a prophet just like you, right? Just like you. And an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, Bring him back with thee into thine house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But notice what God says. But he lied unto him. And so he went back with him and did eat bread in his house and drank water. So here, when the young man refuses, citing the terms of his commission, then the wicked old man pretended to have received a direct revelation from God, saying, Well, now that you've discharged your mission, oh, that's gone. It's all right for you to come home with me. You know, we're on the same side. We're brothers in the faith. Wink, wink, nod, nod, you know. You can just see him trying to convince this guy. Besides, my boys are eager to meet you. They were tremendously impressed by your courage, your conviction, and power. And so the deceiver lays siege to the young man's heart. But God tells us that he lied to him. So the young man, he's sitting there thinking about it for a minute. He saw that it was getting dark. It was at the end of the day. And he could hear the roar of a lion out in the hills. And the young man was hungry and he was tired. And so at last he yields to the old prophet. And he became disobedient to the heavenly vision, and the consequence was his death warrant. And after the deed was done, while the men were still sitting at the dinner table, God spoke to the young man through the old prophet. First, yeah, here we got the prophet actually does have God speaking to him. Yeah, through him. This was a change in the old prophet's life, okay? Verses 20 through 22, and it came to pass, as they sat at the table, that the word of the Lord came unto the prophet that brought him back. And he cried unto the man of God that came from Judah, saying, Thus saith the Lord, for as much as thou hast disobeyed the mouth of the Lord, and hast not kept the commandment which the Lord thy God commanded thee, but camest back, and hast eaten bread and drank water in this place, of the which the Lord did say to thee, Eat no bread and drink no water, thy carcass shall not come into the sepulchre of thy fathers. And the Bible tells us in the rest of the story that a lion attacked and killed the young prophet because he had been disobedient. And then God describes the old prophet, or the wicked man's, doom as well. Verse 15, chapter 6 of the book of Proverbs says, Therefore shall his calamity come suddenly. Suddenly shall he be broken without remedy. And, you know, hearing of the young prophet's death, and receiving the warning from the Holy Spirit, the old prophet ended up burying the young prophet from Judah in his own grave in Bethel. And at the end of the episode, the old man was obsessed by thoughts of his own death, which he realized was not very far away. He had sealed his own doom by his wickedness. And he said to his sons in verse 31 of 1 Kings chapter 13, And it came to pass after he had buried him that he spake to his sons, saying, When I am dead, then bury me in the sepulcher wherein the man of God is buried, lay my bones beside his bones. So the advice that God is giving us is that you cannot deceive God. And those who break God's commandments, those who transgress God's moral laws, the wicked man never escape his judgment. Now, the message today contains God's wisdom on how to handle our business life and our moral life. It's a pretty simple lesson, right? You'd think I'd spent 2 weeks trying to study this, but it was a pretty simple lesson. It didn't take a whole lot of preparation on this, right? I mean, this is pretty common sense stuff. It just tells us to beware of borrowing or co-signing on a loan. Then it tells us that it takes hard work to succeed in anything that we need to do, most of all in completing the work that God has for us to do, that we ought to be about doing God's business and God's work because we want to do it, not because he's forcing us to do it, not because we have to do it, because it's in our nature to want to do God's work. In other words, don't be a sluggard. And then we are to beware of the wicked person who has no other intention than to harm us. Now, these seem like pretty common sense pieces of advice. The question is, are we smart enough to listen and apply it to our lives? Amen? Amen.